Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we have a look at three questions that were raised out of Sunday's sermon. Sunday was the last Sunday in our January series, Jesus and the Sydney Morning Herald, in which we try to look at contemporary issues through the lens of faith and theology. And we spent some time looking at the attention economy. The world in which we live, where our attention has been monetized, because in an information-rich environment, it is attention that gets consumed. We're very aware, even if we're unfamiliar with the term, we're familiar with living in that kind of an economy. And I talked a little bit about, you know, the negatives of it, which there are quite substantial negatives to the attention economy, particularly as it relates to things, say, like social media. And then reflected a little bit on, you know, how we can begin to regain our agency, our ability to act as Christians in the face of that kind of an environment. Used a formula from Kevin Van Hooser, speaking about cultural literacy and theological competence and gospel performance being the basis of Christian cultural agency, and talked a bit about how instead of paying attention and using the imagery and the metaphor of economics, of paying, instead to begin to give our attention to things, whether that be our social media accounts or to people or to things in the world. And so out of that, there are a handful of questions that were raised, we're going to look at the following three. So the first is, does the Bible give encouragement on us giving attention to things we don't want to do? For example, tough relationships, studying, or our health. And I'm going to take that in the sense of speaking about things that we don't necessarily want to do but are actually good for us, rather than giving our attention to things that are bad for us, of which the Bible has a bit to say. Secondly, not to be black and white, which is, of course, one of the things I talked about in terms of the attention economy and the way that we become black and white when our society values judgment over understanding because there's so much information. But not to be black and white, but is social media sinful? So we'll have a crack at that, and in terms of without being black and white. And then third, the culture, theology, and gospel framework was helpful. Can you give another example of its use? And that's related to cultural literacy, theological competence, and gospel performance, how we can use it as a framework for our own ethical thinking. So those will be the questions that will accompany us over the next half hour or so. So why don't we dive in? So the first question, does the Bible give encouragement on us giving attention to things we don't want to? So tough relationship studying and our health. And I guess the simple answer is yes, it does. one of the persistent themes that you find, particularly in the New Testament, related to our following after Jesus, of course, is the theme of perseverance. And while a lot of what, you know, Paul and Peter and John and others have to say about perseverance has to do with our spiritual life, our discipleship, our following after Jesus and remaining faithful to him, I think the principle that undergirds it is applicable to lots of other things that are good for us in which we have to persevere, right? The perseverance that builds character and those sorts of things. And so I reckon that whether it's studying or a relationship that's important but is, you know, going through a rough patch, or is a relationship that's important but that's just a lot of hard work for whatever reason, perseverance, I think, provides us with a really good place to think about those things. Study's a good example as well. You know, often, particularly when you get out of high school and, you know, you start making like choices about your education. That can help with your motivation, right? Because your interests have been piqued. But at the same time, there can be times it's just a slog. And so being able to lean back on, you know, perseverance and those sorts of things, I think are really important. I would also probably turn to the wisdom literature and the book of Proverbs, in which it speaks often about, you know, I guess the importance of, it doesn't use the terms, you know, work ethic or you know, a sense of industry. But there is quite a bit that the Proverbs have to say about, you know, hard work in important things that are not necessarily exciting things. You know, part of our culture, I think, right now, tries to tell us that the only things that are important are exciting things. But there's a lot of life that is that's not very exciting, and in some cases is really boring, but is also really important, right? Doing dishes is important, right? Whether that's putting them in the dishwasher or actually washing them by hand, doing laundry is important. They're not particularly exciting activities. They're not the sorts of things that you kind of hope to be professional at, right? But they're really important, and there's lots of those sorts of things, and I wouldn't say it's perseverance in those. Like, you don't persevere to do the chores, but you just do what is important because you know that it is important. And so whether it's dull or exciting work, you still nonetheless have to do it. And so I think there's a sense of, you know, it's kind of the opposite of slothfulness, right? The sin of laziness, which is really not about lying around and doing nothing. Laziness, in kind of its classic definition as a deadly sin, is more about spending time doing things that aren't important. So one of my favorite images of this deadly sin was a series of drawings that had been done by an artist. And the representation of slothfulness was this, you know, beautiful young woman in this blue dress, kind of a gauzy dress, so you know, like the, you know, the big rippling kind of skirt to it, and she's swinging on a swing, blowing bubbles. Now, I don't know, I've never tried this, but sitting on a swing and trying to swing appropriately, you know, swinging the legs and all that sort of thing, but only holding on with one hand so that I can blow bubbles with the other, I mean, that would take some time and attention, right? She's working hard, but she's working hard to blow bubbles. There's no industry to that. And I think that's a wonderful definition of slothfulness, right? It's not just about lying around on the lounge. It's about doing things. You can be terribly busy and incredibly lazy at the same time. You're very, 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 very busy doing things that aren't actually important. And I think, you know, in that sense then, you know, when it comes to doing things that we don't necessarily want to do, but they are important things, well, yeah, there's another kind of example for us that there's something about God's world that suggests that doing those dull but important things is the way to a successful life. And so, yeah, those are two foundations, I think, that we have for perseverance and industry in actions and giving our attention to things that we don't necessarily want to do. Obviously, I'm focusing a little bit more on the doing of those things than just kind of giving our attention to them. But I think, you know, to do jobs well, you have to put your attention to them as well, and think through, you know, the why and the how and all of those sorts of things. So I hope that's helpful for that question, and it leads into a little bit, I think, into our second question. So the second question is this: not to be black and white, but is social media sinful? That's a good question, particularly with the opening, right? That not being black and white. And as I said, I mentioned this briefly in the introduction. One of the downsides of an attention economy where our attention is fragmented is that we have to value judgment over understanding. There's so much information coming at us so quickly all the time that we don't really have time to, you know, carefully and thoughtfully reflect on what we're hearing and then choose what to do with it. Like, it's just flowing at us so quickly that we really have to react. We're judging things right away. And when judgment becomes the key value, right? When that's the important thing, you just got to kind of choose, judge. Like, what are we doing with this? Quick. That leads to black and white thinking. Like, that's because that's a situation where I am not going to be engaging in ambiguity here. I'm not going to be fooling around in the gray areas, although there may be them. I'm just going to make a snap judgment on this. And so I think we do find it difficult sometimes to hold two things in tension or to live in the ambiguity and the gray and all of those sorts of things, particularly in an attention economy. But the question is really less about the black and white thinking and more about, is social media sinful? I'm going to rely on the not to be black and white. I think that it can be, right? I think it can be. I think there are lots of things that we encounter in the world that, shall we say, can be used for sin. Things that can contribute to a sinful life or to a bad habit or a horrible attitude, right? Like, there's no end of good things that can be turned to bad ends, right? I think we know this. You know, you think about something like, something like alcohol, right? Is having a beer or a glass of wine with some friends, is that sinful? I don't think it is. Can it become so? If it becomes excessive, if it leads to drunkenness and all sorts of really horrible decisions that often come with drunkenness, then yeah, it can become a place for sinfulness. So I would not want to say that social media is automatically and by definition sin, which I think is what the question's getting at. But I do think there's some value then in us asking some questions about where are the potential pitfalls for sinful behavior, right? I think the slothfulness, if I can come back to that momentarily, I think that's a place where we can be sinful with social media or any number of things, really, right? If slothfulness is really about not giving attention to the things that need our attention and deserve our attention, but is just being, so you can be busy but still be lazy, right? Well, then there's a space in which our social media use can become, for example, laziness, like keeping us from doing the things that we really ought to do. Now, does that mean that, you know, sitting there for 5 or 10 minutes, whatever, between things or when you first get home or whatever it is, you know, during lunch and scrolling is a lazy thing? No, not necessarily. Again, it's not a matter of being black and white, but I think that's a space for it. You know, I think that the comment section seems to me to be a place where sin might flourish, right? Where we can say things that are unkind or hurtful. You know, the week before we were talking a bit about hate speech and free speech and whatnot. And, you know, I think we can say, and things are said on social media that are, I mean, if they're not sinful, I don't know what you'd call them, right? They're just downright vile and they're mean, you know, and we don't have to talk about meanness as being sinful. But if you think about the life of heaven, I can't imagine that there's going to be a lot of mean-spiritedness anymore, right? All those sorts of things, I think, are spaces where, we can end up allowing space for sin to grow. I think we can end up becoming a little bit inoculated against some of the outrageous things that we see because so much of it comes past us. And so if we allow ourselves to sit in that space too much, I think that becomes a place where it's sinful or can become sinful. You know, when we end up, just kind of it can erode our faith or our beliefs in ways that are unhelpful. So I think that, you know, in brief, there are some ways I think that social media can be used for sinful ends and can be a place where sinful attitudes and thoughts and behaviors can be allowed to flourish. It doesn't mean that every single social media platform is a bad thing and that every time we open it up, it's a, you know, it's a crime against humanity. I mean, you know, I think there are some bigger picture pieces around, you know, the monetizing of our attention, you know, and the fact that, you know, the sensationalism and the scandal and the outrage is optimized not for our good, but for money. And I think that is almost sinful. I was quite swayed by one of the essays I read last week where the author just talked about how it's morally objectionable that some of these social media platforms are designed to become addictive flourish when they fragment our attention and disable our ability to make our own choices. And I think he was right in that space. That doesn't mean, again, that a social media platform is necessarily evil, but it's certainly not designed for our good. And so I think there's some spaces where we have to be careful as we tread. You know, I think the place that we spent time on Sundays are wrapped around, you know, how much attention do we give to it? And I think anything that we give too much attention to can be a bad thing. So we just have to manage that a little bit, you know, individually, I suppose. Being aware of where we are prone to sin. And I think, you know, that might be different for each one of us, right? In terms of how we respond and react to what we see and what we engage with and what we give our attention to. So again, hope that's helpful. Not black and white. It's not black and white. It's pretty complicated, I think, for lots. But there are spaces, I think, where it can be sinful, where it can lead towards that, right? It can become a bit of a path that if we follow it to its end, it's not going to end well for us either. So I think we do have to be aware of the things in our lives that can lead to and the shape that those sins can take for us as well. The last question is about that formula from Kevin Van Hooser. The culture, theology, and gospel framework was helpful. Can you give another example of its use? I can. I'm going to give you a couple of examples that are a little bit simpler and a better place to learn how to use the framework, if I can put it that way. One of the challenges... So I came across Kevin Van Hooser's book, Everyday Theology, that he edited when I was doing some work around culture and worldview. And part of my interest in culture and worldview, particularly in relationship to Christianity, was driven by the fact that I had begun to realize and recognize just how blinded I was to my culture. You know, as I said on Sunday, we often know how to navigate our culture. Like, it makes sense to us and we can make our way around it. We're not confused by it, but we also don't know how it works. And for me, it was a conversation that I had with some colleagues about consumerism in the church. And, you know, we had this conversation and we were all people who worked in a church. And the conversation kind of revolved around church shopping. And I suppose some of the things that we were observing about, you know, the ways people were thinking about churches and what church shopping meant and all of those sorts of things, I suppose they were valid. But we finished the conversation and I was really uneasy with it because I knew that I had been raised in a consumerist culture. Right? Like, I knew it. But none of our observations were about how we, the committed by occupation, have allowed consumerism to influence our experience of church. And I couldn't think of any ways that was the case. Like, it was just this blind spot for me. And so I began doing some thinking and reading in that area. I actually had an opportunity to do some teaching in it, which was really helpful. Nothing like having to prepare some lectures on something to get you thinking about it. But I came across Van Hooser and a number of other really helpful tools in some of that expansion. And one of the things that I realized was that tackling consumerism right off the bat was too big. Right? It's kind of like, you know, you've just started driving and you get behind the wheel of a tank or something, or they throw you in an airplane and say, hey, you know, yeah, it's got wheels and stuff, just drive it. It's like the gap between my skills and capacity and what you're asking me to do is just too big. Like an ism, capitalism, consumerism, socialism, whatever it is, those are massive, huge systems that are interrelated with other systems, really difficult to analyze, shall we say. And so one of the things that I began to value was trying to find really simple things to apply some of these frameworks to. So this idea of, you know, cultural literacy and theological competence and gospel performance, I began, particularly in some of my lectures, I began to get students to like look at advertisements, to watch a short commercial, for instance, and talk a little bit about what the commercial tells us about, you know, the ideal world and what's wrong and all of that, to get us thinking a little bit about, you know, what does our theology have to say about that? So like, you know, we would look at beer ads, or shampoo ads, and what they would say, and just try to really pay attention to, you know, how is this picture, how is this image shot, and who's in it, and what's actually happening in it, and then thinking about it. And I found that really helpful as kind of a training wheel exercise, because, as I said, like consumerism is way too big to just jump into, but I can look at a candy bar ad and go, I can pull that part a little bit, right? And, you know, so I suppose the examples then would be, you know, look at the next ad that pops up on your social media feed, right? If you want a simple example, right? Look at the next ad. I'm not sure you want to click on the link lest you never, ever, ever stop seeing it in your feed, but like pay attention to the ad and do a couple of things. So in terms of cultural literacy, give attention, right, to what's going on in the ad. So, describe it. They talk about, in sociology, they talk about thick and thin descriptions. The thin description is just describing what's happening in it, right? So describe what the person or the people are wearing and what, what colors are used and, you know, what's the logo and like just just exactly what you see. A thick description is trying to identify some of the meaning behind it. You know, I'm not sure if you've seen those Corona ads, the Corona beer ads, you know, from a place you'd rather be is their tagline. And they're always like a young group of people, right? Maybe six or seven of them, casually but coolly dressed, driving down some wonderful coastal road. It's kind of out in the bush, and then they find some place and they're just relaxed and chilling and sitting back with a beer and like and from the place you'd rather be. And so you want to kind of talk about, you know, have a look at what's going on, where is this shot, what are the scenes that they're showing, and then the meaning of it. Right. And that just kind of helps you kind of go, what are they trying to get me to do? Right. It's because it's not just buy a beer and buy our beer. There's something more going on there. And that will help you explore the cultural literacy part. And then you want to start asking a little bit about theological competence. And I found it quite helpful from a theological competence perspective to think, I mean, you can think about biblical passages that talk about or against what's going on, but it's more helpful, I think, to think about it from a worldview perspective. So, you know, like those Corona ads, you know, the world that they describe has some elements of what I would call the created good, the start of the, not what I would call, but what is called the created good, right? It's the start of the Christian story. It's that God created the world and it was very, very good. And there's a bunch of stuff in those ads that are very, very good. You know, groups of people, men and women hanging out together. There's something really nice about that rest component. There's something about the beauty of the outdoors. There's something about, right, having something that they enjoy the taste of, right? And there's a bunch of stuff in that you go, oh, that's kind of good. And then there's a bunch of stuff, of course, that is reflective of the broken world we live in, the kind of the second part of the Christian story. So where do we see evidence of the breakdown? Well, there aren't any kids. There aren't any older people there. There's no industry or work taking place. Like, it just seems to be completely removed from there. It's kind of this whimsical, you know, from place you'd rather be, you know. So like, what about where I am and the importance of being where I am? And then you want to think about the difference that Jesus makes. You know, so what do we do with this, you know, in terms of the new world order? Like, what might this, if we transposed this ad and it got shown in heaven, what would it look like there? You know, would there be additional components to it? Would there, you know, how would it get framed up? And that then helps you then think through then the gospel performance. And the gospel performance piece for me is actually, you know, from last week's message, really, about Richard Niebuhr's five paradigms, right? Do we run away from it? Do we embrace it? Do we embrace some of it and call it up to kind of a better expression? Do we just have to hold something in tension, or is this a space where we are actually being called to transform something? And those five actions, I think, are a pretty good set of five to think through, right? So, you know, when it comes to Corona, right? I've watched the ad. I've thought a little bit about it from the cultural perspective and from the theological perspective. And then I think, well, you know, I guess I'm going to have to hold this intention. Like, I get what they're saying, and I guess Corona's a nice beer, and, you know, off we go. Or we kind of go, listen, what it stands for and what it represents, I can't embrace any of that, and I'm not going to have anything to do with that company anymore. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes into this, and it's an inexact science. It's a little bit more of an art in lots of ways. That's one of the things that I've learned about this. And so I think the examples then would, you could use anything. So I had my students look at ads, and I had them look at a music video, you know, a song that was popular at the time, and just got people to think about it and, you know, what's going on, and then think about it biblically and theologically and all those sorts of things. And start small would be my advice. If you want to tackle capitalism right off the bat, like, knock yourself out, but it's going to be a lot of work. Learning to pay attention to what we see in front of us in our culture is actually fairly helpful. And you start paying attention differently then too. You know, so the other example, I can't remember, I think it was when I was doing some study in Revelation, not in culture, but nonetheless, there was I think it was a BMW ad. It was a car ad. It was BMW because they said, we have a peace of mind guarantee. And I thought to myself, you can't promise that. A guarantee, a warranty on my car is not going to give me peace of mind. It might give me a little bit of peace of mind about what happens to my car, but it's not going to give me peace of mind. That's you're over-promising. And I don't believe that they were trying to make some sort of blasphemous statement about, you know, find peace in our guarantee, not in God. But that was kind of what was raised out of it for me, just kind of seeing the claims and going, you know what, I know what they mean, but it's a much bigger statement about where I find peace of mind. I find peace of mind in insurance, right? Like, okay. So that gets you thinking a little bit about the role of insurance and faith and all of those sorts of things. A little bit rambly, I will admit. It was a question that got me going. So, yeah, but I hope that's helpful. The techniques and tools, some of the things that I've been talking about over the last few weeks in particular, this formula by Van Hooser, the Niebuhr's five paradigms. There's something I use, kind of referred to it there, about the created good and the impact of sin and the difference Jesus makes, and then what it might look like in heaven. That's something called the four chairs. At least that's how I was introduced to it. By Paul Winsor, a New Zealand theologian and preacher. You sit in the good chair and think about something from the perspective of the created good, and what vestiges of that do we see? And then the bad chair, which is the impact of sin, the redeemed chair, the good chair, or sorry, the redeemed chair, which is what difference does Jesus make? And then the perfect chair, about what it might look like. And so some of these tools I find really helpful, and in each of them, trying to think about simple examples, I found helpful to kind of train me to learn some of the skills required to be a better Christian cultural agent, to act as a Christian in my world. So again, I hope that's been helpful. I hope you've enjoyed the series. I always enjoy preaching it. It's different kind of work, but very, very enjoyable. It's It's an opportunity to stretch and try some new things and to learn some new stuff and to think differently about the world in which I live as well. So it's always good fun to do. Next week, we start back into our theme. Well, not back into our theme, but introduce our theme, working out our salvation together. I'm looking forward to that over the next couple of weeks. And then we're going to be diving into the book of Romans, which is going to be our biblical series kind of for the year. We'll do 5 or 6 weeks every term over the course of the year and cover hopefully the entire book of Romans. We'll obviously see how we go because there's a lot to unpack in Romans, and that's going to be good fun as well. I hope you can join me on Sunday as we launch into the ministry year and that you'll join me again next week for the big three. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.